Hi, this is Alan Chartok, and on this day, after Thanksgiving, as you try to figure out what to do with those holiday leftovers, we'll help you find some special recipes to make those dishes more interesting. That's why I'm really delighted to be in conversation today with award-winning chef Brendan Walsh, Dean of Culinary Arts at the CIA. No, not that CIA, the Culinary Institute of America. Chef Walsh oversees the curriculum development and management of culinary arts education at the college and is responsible for the quality of academic programming, services, and staffing of culinary arts courses. He assumed his current job in 2012 after serving 4 years as a faculty member and associate dean at the CIA. By the way, we love the CIA. We go there a lot and we program there for a lot, and they're terrific. A 1980s CIA graduate, Chef Walsh returned to his alma mater in 2008. Before that, he was owner and executive chef of Elms Restaurant and Tavern in Ridgefield, Connecticut, North Street Grill in Great Neck, New York, and Coyote Grill in Island Park, New York, as well as the founder and president of Chef Brendan Walsh Services, FWF Consulting, who's also a director of operations and executive chef of 661 North Corporation in Island Park and Sign of the Dove Corporation in New York City. Earlier in his career, Chef Walsh held various chef positions at highly regarded restaurants around the country, including executive chef of Arizona 206 in New York City, Water's Edge in Long Island City, New York, and Ancient Mariner in Florida, New York, and Connecticut, chef of Gotham Bar and Grill in New York City, and sous chef at Stars in San Francisco. Walsh served as lead chef for the Connecticut Farmland Trust from 1998 to 2010. A member of the James Beard Foundation, Brendan is one of the three CIA faculty and staff members to have been inducted into that organization's Who's Who of Food and Beverages in America, receiving the honor in 1987. You can find out more about Chef Walsh at www.ciachef.edu. We'll talk to Chef Walsh about all of this and much more. But first, welcome Chef Dean Walsh.
Thank you, Alan. Thanks for having me on the program. I appreciate any time I get to talk about turkey. Love it.
Chef Dean Walsh, which of those appellations is more important to you, chef or dean?
Well, I have to say that I love being called chef because I think it's a true honor. I originally got into this whole business because of the ability of a chef to bring people around a table and see them enjoy a meal. It just got me going as a very, very young man. I just thought, wow, I can do that. I can cook food and bring people happiness. Wow, I want to do that. So I love being known as a chef. Now, I'm not too embarrassed by being the dean. It's quite an accomplishment.
You know, there are two titles in this country where the receptionist will say, or the waitress will say, not the doctor will see you now, but doctor will see you now,
right,
or chef will see you now, or chef said. It never takes a the. Have you ever thought about that?
In our world now, with chefs becoming so popular, it doesn't surprise me. The respect for chefs has grown incredibly, if you think about it, in the last 30 to 40 years. They've really come of their own, and they're so connected to everything that's so important right now, all these things that surround food, resources, and it goes back to government policies. So there's a very, very big linkage to so many issues around the food world. So it's a great time to be a chef, really.
You owned all those restaurants, and now you're back at the CIA. Now, you know, I know you. They pay you guys a lot of money to be celebrity chef at one of those places. Did you save your money and therefore decide you wanted to be a dean again or come back and do this? Or are they paying you more money than any academic has ever been paid in the history of mankind?
It's a combination of a bunch of things. I mean, it was always a dream for me to come back to the CIA to teach. And then, you know, naturally, as a chef, you're a manager of people. So a chef is a leader. It's the person that has to bring all these pieces together, has to be able to react to situation in a very quick manner. So for me, being in administration is a very natural fit. You know, there's a lot of things that come at me very, very quickly. So I enjoy the fact that now I can help influence so many, you know, 2,000 students a year that are going to go into our food systems and help open their minds to looking at a lot of the issues that surround food and what they can do in terms of being the new chefs of the future. Because chefs can make incredible differences in food systems. Just in buying one product alone, they can buy out markets. So we have a responsibility to, you know, be informed leaders.
You know, my wife still wakes up, the lovely Roselle, you know, a doctorate, full professor for years, author, and everything else, but she still wakes up in a cold sweat thinking she's back at the restaurant that she used to work in the Hudson Valley with the chef being mean to her. Are chefs like political leaders? Here's the political scientist coming out, some of whom are dictators and others who are Democrats, Moldy?
Well, I believe that if you looked at the food business, the restaurant industry 30 years ago, it was definitely a dictatorship. There's no two ways about it. I think there's a lot more to be said now for a lot of the American chefs that have made an unbelievable difference in terms of kitchen management, in terms of collaboration. Because you've got so many people that are coming into this business with so many different perspectives. And I found that to be true, too. Arizona 206 was extremely successful in New York City because we had a very collaborative environment. We looked for creative people that had a passion, hardworking, but had a passion and could add to the food that we were serving. And so everybody was able to participate. And through that participation, the quality of the food items were, you know, exponential. So we were doing things that were way, you know, ahead of their times because you had so many people that were and part of that creative process. By the way, I do still wake up with some shivering about certain things that happened in the restaurant.
when you were a sous chef and not chef.
Mm-hmm.
So, Brendan Walsh, let's talk about the day after Thanksgiving. I'm finding the rest of this very interesting, and especially your biographical background. But let's talk about the day after Thanksgiving. I'm making the turkey for our group of probably by the time it's done, about 25 people. So I read something in the New York Times the other day that I think it was in the Times that gave me, it was really interesting, which is there are too many people who want the legs and the dark meat, and there's too much white meat in a turkey. So what you do is you buy separate turkey legs and turkey, you know, thighs and broil them at the same time you're making the turkey. What do you think about that?
That is really interesting. I know there's a move towards more, people are liking the dark meat more and more, and it used to be the opposite way. So it's so interesting. Well, you know, I don't think it's a bad practice if you find that. What I found was, you know, I would get my family involved with the plating of the food. So when we plated it, we added a percentage of both. So it was a preset plate.
Right. Tough noogies. Tough noogies. You're getting this.
The problem is that now you're adding more complexity to your day. Of complexity. So there's so much going on Thanksgiving. You have so many different sides you're serving. And you got 25 people. That's a lot of people.
Yeah.
And if you're doing one really large bird, and usually for 25 people, you probably want to do two birds, two like 16 pounders, because that'll give you enough leftovers to have fun with. You know, that's a lot of space and a lot of time, a lot of coordination. So, I can say this, that what we used to do at the restaurant for production reasons was we would take the legs off.
Ah.
And then we would roast the breast separately so we could time it so that it was absolutely moist and wonderful. And then the legs, what we would do is we would take the thighs, roll and tie them so we could slice them. And then we would take the leg and we would braise those.
Now that you've mentioned it, because, you know, I have not earned the right to be called a chef yet. What in fact is the best way to make that turkey, although this is the day after, maybe for next year? In other words, I have always been a believer in the foil wrapped. It goes faster and it maintains some of the juices. But there have been setbacks, let's put it that way, of a little bit too dry. So what do you do? What's the best way to do it?
Well, I was going to talk to you a little bit about food safety today because, you know, surrounding the whole Thanksgiving thing is the 250,000 cases a year of illnesses related to food safety practices.
Yep.
So we do have to talk about. So I want to say that one tool that every household should have, and it costs about $5, and you can get it at ShopRite, you can get it at Stop and Shop, you can get it at any supermarket, is a thermometer.
Right.
Now, it's really, really key to learn how to use that thermometer. If you can understand about temping your turkey, you'll stop that dryness issue. Because what happens is people are cooking the turkey internally up until like 190 degrees. And the other people use that little plastic valve that pops up. Sometimes those things don't work correctly. So the simplest and safest and smartest tool you can buy is a thermometer. It's $5. Have a thermometer. The key number is 165. So 165 hits on a couple of things. One is it's going to keep your turkey moist. It's also going to be a pathogen deterrent. So any kind of pathogens are basically killed off at 165. So bacterial components is a safe temperature to cook your turkey to. So if you cook it to 165 degrees, you know that your food is safe. Second thing is to make sure you rest the bird. I can't tell you how many people pull the bird out of the oven. They wait 5 minutes. And it smells so good. They're starving. And they start hacking away at the thing. As soon as you do that, you've not allowed those muscles to relax and to allow the juices to go back into the muscle tissue. And it just, you cut. And boom, you're just watching all the juices flow away, and you wonder why you have a dry turkey. You need to allow that turkey to rest for a good 20, 30 minutes. I'm a big proponent of allowing it to rest for up to 45 minutes.
Wow.
And then you just pop it in the oven to warm it up, and then you slice and serve, and it comes out perfect, absolutely perfect. So that's a really, really important hint in terms of cooking your bird for the first time around.
But I want to go back to my original question, if I can, there for a second, Brendan. I mean, what's the best method for doing it? I mean, is it just sticking the thing in the oven at a particular time, or is it better to do my foil wrap method?
Well, I think temperature. So I don't know your oven. So everybody's got a different oven.
Sure.
So I'm thinking about it, this kind of cumulative, how many different types of ovens. Most of them are cooking in a home oven with electric. So the pan that you use, getting the turkey off the bottom of the pan is very, very important.
Mm.
Turning it once is really, really a great technique. So if you start with the breast down, so you can crisp up the one side of the bird. And generally, if you're getting a 16-pound bird, at 350 to 375, you're going to be able to start crisping up that skin. Turn it over after about 45 minutes, and then crisp it up on the other side. And it'll probably take you somewhere, with the legs on, around an hour and a half to 2 hours to cook a bird that's 16 pounds with the legs on. With the legs off, it only takes you an hour. But you want to get that temperature is 165. I don't know how hot your oven is, how well it holds heat, and all those factors, but that's a good basic understanding. And that's why that thermometer thing is so important, because it doesn't matter if you put foil over it, if you brine it, if you're just dry roasted, if you put a little salt and pepper on it, those things are immaterial to the cooking of the bird. The main thing is that temperature and not getting it above 165 and allowing it to rest. Those are the two biggest factors in terms of the bird. My personal preference, I've had some brined birds, which I absolutely love. You brine it, and then you dry it really well, and you roast it at 350 degrees for about an hour and a half to an internal temperature about 165, and then allow it to rest, and it's juicy and wonderful.
Okay, hold on a second. Define, because there are some of us who really are not very smart about this stuff, define what brining means.
Okay, so a brine is basically taking your bird, removing everything from the inside, and then you put it in a flavored brine. So some people will take maple syrup, some salt, water, and then different spices. So there'll be bay leaf in there. Some people use mustard seeds. And you could find 50 brine recipes for a turkey online in 10 seconds. But basically a brine is you cover the whole bird. It sits in there for approximately 12 hours. You put it overnight generally. And what it does is it gets a little salty, sweet, wonderfulness to it, infuses that spice flavor into the bird before you roast it. It's delish.
But you need a big enough holder to brine in. I mean, you're not just talking about slopping some stuff on top of the turkey. You're talking about, you know, basically putting it in the bathtub.
Right. Yeah, you do. You put it. Some people, what they'll do is they'll put it inside of a garbage bag.
Uh-huh.
And then inside of a garbage bag, inside of a garbage can, make sure the can is clean, and then pour the brine over the bird like that. The other way to do it is a cooler.
Ah.
You can brine your bird in a cooler.
Ooh, yeah.
Which was another suggestion I wanted to make, which is a good way for you, if your refrigerator's overpacked, pull your summer coolers out. And I looked up the average temperature over the last 10 years in this area, and it's approximately 40 degrees. So you could go back porch with cooler and ice, and you could cool things down because you're going to be out 40 degrees, which is your refrigerator temperature. One big mistake people make is they take a lot of items and they throw it in their refrigerator. It's all hot, and they bring down their temperature of their refrigerator, which is spoiling everything. which is not good for your food.
Wow. Well, so to review, the temperature you're cooking at is 365, right?
Yeah, 350, 365, right in that range.
Okay. And the internal temperature from your thermometer is 165?
Correct.
Okay. So we have to cook it, but then we have to let it cool down.
Rest.
For about 40 minutes, and then you say we can even put it back in the oven for a few minutes just to do that. Okay. Oh, and one last thing, I want to know a psychological thing about the guy who always stands by the turkey when it's being carved and starts to eat stuff from the turkey. Is that what a knife was invented for?
Well, definitely the knife was invented for that if he doesn't wash his hands.
Right, right. So. Right. Those guys really annoy me because, you know. Because
yeah,
that doesn't
seem
fair.
To focus.
Yeah, it doesn't seem fair. Okay. Now, a lot of people have community Thanksgivings, you know, like somebody brings the this, somebody brings the that. You know, and then I got, years ago, I used to make, for our communal Thanksgiving with our very good friends in Connecticut, I used to make the stuffing, and I used to include chicken giblets. Now, this annoyed everybody, and I put prunes in also, where I was persona non grata. I wasn't allowed to bring the, I wasn't allowed to bring the thing anymore. They never heard of chicken giblets.
Well, yeah, the whole giblets thing is a very New England thing because they were thrifty. They were one-pot cookers. They were people that used everything. Nothing would go to waste. Mm-hmm. It was just actually sacrilegious to waste any type of food item. So giblets became part of that giblet gravy, for example, and definitely like the liver would be put into the stuffing.
That's disgusting.
Of course.
Okay, but also giblets, as you say, were selling at the time for 10 cents a pound or something. I remember my twin brother, Lewis, you know, he would eat giblets every night when he was a graduate student because they were cheap. But we don't see much of that anymore. But I digress. Okay, let's talk about the day after. Oh, I wanted to talk to you about this communal thing. So people show up with assigned things, and there is wide deviance between, you know, the quality of the stuff. So, I mean, how do you deal with that?
There's different sides of the table, you know what I mean? So the back side of the table are the ones you push back to the back.
Oh,
those
that's
ones
good.
That are questionable. I'm not going to make any judgments.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I was never a fan of, like, the sweet potato with the marshmallow thing on top. Never got that
thing. I agree. How about creamed onions? Creamed onions, that's terrible.
Yeah. I'm more of a like a caramelized pearl onion or a caramelized cipollini onion guy.
Those what does caramelized mean?
Caramelized is basically when you brown them in a pan just enough to bring out the sugars on that onion,
and then
you finish them by roasting them, and they have this wonderful sweetness to them that is just delish. I really, really like that. So, listen, I want to make one mention. You talked about stuffing. There's a couple of things. Stuffing the next day, really important. Again, bring out that $5 thermometer and stick it in there. Make sure it's 165 degrees before you serve it to anybody if you're reheating it. Okay? So two key numbers to remember is 165 today on the temperature of the bird, right, and reheating items. The second one is below 40. So you want to get your food below 40 as fast as possible to cool them and to keep them out of what we call the danger zone, where bacteria growth is the highest.
And where is that? What numbers? What are the numbers for bacteria growth?
It's between 40
and
140, very simply put. 40 and 140 is where the majority of bacteria, and the super area is between 70 and 100 degrees is where bacteria growth is maximized. So holding at those temperatures for a long period of time is verboten.
But based on what you're saying, I should be dead. Now, I tell you why, because, you know, we take this stuff out, and before we recook it or reheat it, I walk by, and I just, you know, grab some and throw it in my mouth. Now, that's when there's mostly going to be bacteria around there, right?
Right. But the thing is, you've done something, though. So what happened was, before that point, you minimized bacteria by killing off most of it because you brought these temperatures way above. You know, you brought all these bacteria into the kill zone first. So you have a good 4 hours this is what is the latest evidence, the best data we have right now. You have a good 4 hours of before that where that bacterial growth is going to grow exponentially, okay?
Wait. No, maybe you didn't understand. Maybe I didn't understand. You take the stuff out of the refrigerator from yesterday, right?
Right.
Now you put it next to the sink, near the sponge with all the bacteria on it. And now...
I'm screwed.
And now you walk by, and every time you walk by, you grab a little, you know? Maybe you grab the giblets. But you're saying that the fact that it was in the refrigerator...
Correct.
...is killing a lot of stuff.
That's right. You got it below 40 rapidly, and you held it at 40 degrees, which is what we know is the minimal amount of bacterial growth below 40 and above 140.
What about the back porch?
And I was saying back porch, man, because I'm telling you, the average temperature outside at Thanksgiving was 40 degrees in the last 10 years.
Right. So if it's the back porch, it's probably okay.
Yeah.
The
thing that happens is, let's say you had a largeness, like you're stuffing, and you stuffed it into like a quart container. Okay. The middle of that is where the biggest concern is, because the middle is where it took the longest to cool down. The edges are going to cool faster, right?
Yeah.
So whenever you cool, you want to cool as flat cooled as possible, like 1 and 1.5 to 2 inches flat cooled. That'll get your temperature down rapidly. So like you can go on the back porch in a flat pan covered, and it'll come down pretty quick. Then you put it into like the square Tupperware container or so on. That's the most efficient, effective, and it doesn't bring your temperature of your refrigerator up.
Interesting. Very interesting. Okay, what else we got here? What about peas?
Do you like peas?
I love peas.
Yeah, so does my wife. My wife loves peas.
Well, if you're on the Weight Watchers, peas are only 1 point. So it's a good thing, and they're very flavorful, especially when they're fresh. But I even like them canned. So now what about peas? Any special precautions?
To be honest with you, keep that rule of thumb. Don't keep the food longer than 3 days. If the rule of thumb is above 165 heat. And most of the time, if you reheated peas, you'd be bringing them above 165.
Right.
And, you know, the goal is not just, you know, salmonella is a huge concern. Salmonella bacteria is a huge concern around chicken and turkeys.
Uh-huh.
So that's one of the ones that we're trying to get above 165 to keep any kind of issues with that. But also, people have to wash their hands. You have other, want to get graphic, that can get passed to food, and that's why we really recommend getting it above 165.
Well, okay, get a little graphic. I mean, what is it that, you know, you're in the...
Well, on the size of a pinhead, you could have over a billion E. coli cells.
Uh-oh.
So, yuck. And it's really hand-washing practices and sanitation practices that can prevent those kind of illnesses.
Well, I love the fact that you can't go into a restaurant with it saying employees must wash their hands.
Mm-hmm.
You know, basically, under penalty of law, like in the planes where they tell you if you smoke, you could be arrested.
That's right.
So apparently, this is very important stuff. Okay. Go ahead.
Let's talk about some food and like in some fun things to do with your leftovers.
Great
so we
idea.
Know that we got these temperature things. You're going to be safe because that's really important to me. You know, your gravy, you're going to make sure you get it above 165 degrees when you put it on that open face sandwich the next day.
Stop. How do you make gravy?
Oh, I got to make the gravy?
Yeah.
You better have made the gravy on Thanksgiving. This is the day after, you know.
I know, but just because next year is coming up. Tell us how you make the gravy.
Okay, so there's two things. One is with a lot of gluten intolerance and so on, a lot of people are thickening their gravy with alternatives. So cornstarch is a simple, very fast alternative to thickening your gravy. It doesn't give you the same mouthfeel, but it gives you that thickness that'll hold to the meat when you eat it. So using cornstarch is a simple thing. And if you don't know how to use cornstarch, I'll give you a quick talk.
Good, because I don't.
You know, you take about a tablespoon to two tablespoons, and you put enough water in it just to make it look like heavy cream. You mix it, and then you bring your liquid to a simmer. So you've got it. It's going to be simmering around 205 degrees.
But not boiling.
And then you slowly pour in your cornstarch. It'll thicken immediately, so you'll know the consistency.
Now, you don't know who you're dealing with here, Chef. You're dealing with an idiot. So before you put the cornstarch in, what are you putting it into?
Oh, you want to go all the way back.
Yeah, I
want
to go all the way.
All right, so I took, you know, when I got the turkey, they have the neck inside of it.
Right.
Right? So I take that neck, I take the wings off of my bird.
Right.
And what I do is I brown those up a little bit.
Yep.
And then I brown up some onion, carrot, and celery. Then I pour chicken stock over that, and I make turkey stock.
What if you did it the Allen way, which is you wait till the whole thing is done, then you take one of those big fat syringes, you know what I mean?
Right.
Those things.
Yep. Yep.
Pull up some of the leavings, put it in a bowl, then add flour to that.
Right.
And chopped up mushrooms. Is there a good reason not to do it my way?
No, it sounds great. I don't know how much you're going to, what do you get, 2 tablespoons? Like everybody gets like a...
You can make a lot.
Oh, you can?
Okay. Yeah, you can make a lot with that because there's a lot of leavings in the bottom of the pan. Of course, it's heart attack stuff. You know, I mean, it is heart attack.
You don't want to lose any of that stuff in the bottom of the pan. Let me tell you how they do it professionally.
Okay.
So what we do in the kitchen is so we would now take the bird while it's resting. We take off some of the excess fat, and usually there's a lot of liquid in there, and we'll cook everything that's in the bottom of that pan, and we'll put it over a burner and cook it down till all the water evaporates out. And now all you're left is some of the turkey fat. Put your flour into that, and then just enough flour for the amount of liquid you have. Now you pour your turkey stock into it.
Right, right.
And you make the best gravy ever. It's right there. And you get all the drippings off the pan, plus you enhanced it with the wonderful flavor you got from cooking out the turkey neck and those vegetables.
But it's incredibly important, I have found out over the years, to take that little plastic bag out of the cavity of the turkey before you roast the turkey.
Absolutely. Please. Please do that.
Okay.
Please do that.
I'll bet I'm not the only one who's ever committed that sin.
No. No, my mother broiled her turkey once. That was a good experience.
Right, right. Okay.
Yep.
Okay, now
the
let's
wrong valve.
Okay, now let's talk about whatever you want to talk about for the day after.
Okay, well, you know, we do a thing called stoup. It's like a tradition. S-T-O-U-P. It's a combination of stew and soup because it's all the great stuff. We took all the leftover turkey bones and everything. Right after dinner, we basically take all the leftover turkey bones, put the meat in a container, and we take all the turkey bones and put them into a pot and make a turkey stock.
Ooh.
For making soup the next day.
Nice.
So it's fabulous. And then we take all the chunks of pieces of meat that really wouldn't work well on a sandwich, etc., and those got part of this stoup. So it's...
What a great idea. Now, because remembering my incapacities here or my inabilities
yep.
here, don't you have to take the fat off the soup at some point? You know, the stoup at some point, you know, put it outside in the 40 degree, and then you
yep.
next morning you see all this layer of stuff that would make you Buddy Hackett, you know, die because he said his, you know, never mind. But you have to get rid of all that stuff, right, before you serve
yeah.
it a soup.
Yeah, so once you make the stocks, what happens is, as they said, as you're saying, and they cool, the fat rises to the top,
right.
and you can peel it right off, and you can put it in the garbage. You get that excess fat away, so you don't have so much fat floating around. Because, yeah, that can be really gross when you get a soup, and there's just this big layer of grease sitting on the top of it, right?
We don't want...
But this is an opportunity for you to use, you know, a lot of vegetables, and maybe some of your roasted vegetables could go in your soup according to how you made them. And so then we add potatoes to it. So we make it very, very hearty. So it's not too heavy, but it's same. It's very, it's filling enough. So it's really a meal. And it's a simple way to use a lot of your leftovers and have a bunch of people together again.
Okay. So what leftovers should you not put in the stoup?
Well, I've watched people, you know, put potatoes. I've seen some people actually put their mashed potatoes into it just to thicken it up a little bit, which
Ooh.
Is kind of interesting. And I don't have any problems with that, again, as long as you get it above 165. Thank you. And what would I not put in there? I would not put any kind of really overly bitter, like if you're a broccoli rabe person, I would not put that in there. But other than that, there's not too many things that I wouldn't think about putting in a stew-style dish, you know?
Right.
Really, it's open.
Should you add
any creamed onions you didn't like?
Yeah, yeah, right. Should you add anything that was not on the Thanksgiving table, or is this sort of a kosher rule here? That you
I would add fresh vegetables. So I would start off with the classic onion, carrot, celery, mirepoix piece,
sure.
you know, and then add other, you know, potatoes or, you know, Brussels sprouts even. That'd be fun to put
right.
in it. I would definitely put peas because Alan likes them.
Do you pre-cook them or not? Do you pre-cook the vegetables, like the carrots and everything else, or do you just throw them in the soup? No.
No, I put them in the bottom, sweat them out a little bit, which is just slowly cooking them in, you know, minimal amount of fat and letting them cook in their own moisture, and then add your stock over the top of it.
God, I'm getting hungry here. I was thinking of adding just a few meatballs to the whole thing. What do you think? Oh, it sounds delicious. Yeah, that would be good. You know, you got your turkey. Do people still cook ham at Thanksgiving? My wife and I had a potential divorce situation when I announced that I wanted to add a ham to our group.
Right.
What's the official word on hams?
Well, I'm not going to say they're out because a lot of people do like them. Some people, I don't have too many friends that don't like them, but I know one or two people that don't like turkey. I just think that's the weirdest thing.
Yeah.
So the ham thing works. And it's also, you know, doing a whole ham is a fairly easy way to feed a lot of people.
Right.
You know? So it's a good, especially if when you're doing those large, large parties, it's an easy fix.
Yeah.
So it's not verboten. But, you know, the classic New England thing is the bird in our generation anyway.
Do you ever think of, you know, when you saw them crossing the road in front of you and, you know, they're sort of gallant creatures. Do you ever think of, you know, ethical responsibility about killing them birds?
Yeah. Well, those wild birds.
Yeah, yeah.
You're definitely braising the meat, the dark meat. I can tell you that. They are so tough.
Oh,
they can
boy.
Be very tough and very dry.
Yeah.
They move around a lot more than our domesticated birds.
What about your goose?
Oh, I love goose. Goose is my Christmas thing.
Oh, is it? Yeah.
Yeah, I love goose. The only problem with goose is that, you know, you spend a fortune and then you end up feeding four people.
You mean you don't get that much off the goose?
No, you don't, but it is delicious.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
I guess with our ethic responsibility to eat less meat and, you know, savor it, I think... You know, so goose isn't a bad thing.
I like your stoop. Anything else you can recommend?
Well, you know, I love that open face sandwich thing because you're using everything, right? You get the stuffing brought to 165 degrees. You got your turkey, and you got your gravy, and then you have a little side of cranberry jelly. I love that thing. My wife likes when I do the pot pies.
Oh,
so she likes when I take
pies.
All the turkey meat and take the stock. Thicken it up and then, you know, do a cream and then make some kind of pastry top. You know, you can buy some commercially made tops that you could put over it and make a turkey pot pie. That's good. I really like that, too, I have to admit.
Wait a second. You said put over it. Doesn't a pot pie have to have something under it, too?
No. Generally, a pot pie is a stew and usually like a fricassee-style stew with a pastry top.
I see.
And then you crunch through the top, and then you get into the stewy part.
Right, right. Do you ever think about calories? You know, I'm a calorie nut. I'm a potential fat man. So, So I think about calories a lot.
Right.
But calories should be suspended for the Thanksgiving holiday, do you think?
Well, I think, again, this kind of practice of honoring the food stuff. So, you know, the problem is we pile the plate so high that if the intake was a little... reduced, I think we'd all be better off in that way and honoring it. So that's kind of where my head's at with it. And also the fact of surrounding it with more plant-based things. But when you do the more plant-based, just don't start loading up with dairy, which is like, you know, butter and cream and so on, which is one of the big things I watch all the time.
Right.
Thanksgiving is a very dairy-rich meal. So you need to look at recipes that get you off the dairy path, especially if you're thinking about calories.
We're in conversation today with award-winning chef Brendan Walsh, Dean of Culinary Arts at the CIA, the Culinary Institute of America, and chef at more restaurants than you could shake a stick at. And chef, you've taken us now through the pot pie idea, which I think is terrific, the stoop, which I think is terrific. What else you got?
Okay. Name an ingredient. Name something from your Thanksgiving.
Yeah. Okay. Giblets. No. Okay. How about
besides giblets?
How about carrots?
Carrots. So one thing that I really love about carrots is their natural sweetness, right? So doing carrots that are, remember I told you about caramelized?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Where you just get them so you get a nice little browning to them. Now, a wonderful little trick for carrots is you get this little browning on them, and then you just put a little bit of maple syrup and coat them very, very lightly with maple syrup, and they get this wonderful double sweetness that is just delicious. Another way to do it is just take a little bit of orange juice and reduce down some orange juice, and you put a little orange zest, orange juice. You make these little orange-flavored carrots.
How do you reduce them?
So what you do is you take the orange juice
yes.
and you just cook it till it evaporates down. It gets syrupy.
Uh-huh.
And then you fold those carrots into that syrupy orange mixture, and it's absolutely delicious.
So here's a crucial question. What kind of carrots are we talking about? Big old carrots? Do we cut them up? Do we the long way or the short way, you know, like that?
Yeah. So what I like to do with the carrots is now I'm really keeping the skin on because there's a lot of nutrients in them, but I wash them really, really well. So I scrub the carrots.
Right.
And then what we do is we cut them into pieces about thumb-sized. So let's say that's about a 3/4-inch cut, you know, little diagonals of the carrot. Try to get them as uniform as you can. And then go into a pan that's fairly hot, just a touch of oil, like I was saying, and then hit those carrots in there until they start to get a little color. Pop them in the oven for about 10 minutes maximum, 5-10 minutes. They'll be nicely caramelized. And those are delicious just on their own with a little bit of salt. You could throw a little bit of fresh herbs on them, and they're perfect just that way. But you can add some other flavorings, as I mentioned.
But I'm still a little left behind in the dust here about cut them into diagonals. What do you mean diagonals?
Mm-hmm. Okay. So if you lay the carrot down in front of you, all right, parallel to where you're standing.
Right.
And you put your knife at basically a 45-degree angle.
Yeah, got it.
And you just cut at a 45-degree angle every inch. You'll end up with these nice little diagonal cut carrots.
Yeah, but then if you cut one way, then in order to get that diagonal, you have to cut the other way, right?
You could do that. And then, wow, now you're getting advanced, Alan.
Okay, all right.
Now you're taking it to the chef's level. That's what the chefs do. So they turn the carrot, and they get this nice little diagonal cut.
Well, that's something. Okay, so carrots. You want me to name something else?
Sure.
Sweet potatoes.
Oh, sweet potatoes. One of my faves. So, in general, most people just, like, waste those things in maple syrup. So they roast them ahead of time.
Yeah,
and you roast them till they're just soft because you're going to go back into the oven. So you roast them so you could peel them.
Yep.
And then you get these nice thick slices. You lay them in a little pan. And people, what people like to do is pour a little bit of maple syrup over it, maple glazed sweet potatoes, and then they put like chopped toasted walnuts or pecans on top of them. And that's a wonderful way to do them. So it's like little pecan and maple roasted sweet potatoes.
Skin on or off?
Skin off.
Skin off.
So you roast them and they get tender. They just start to get tender. You peel them and then you have these nice sweet potatoes that you can slice and fan out in a little, like, pie dish is a great way to do it. Pour a little maple syrup over it, put a little bit of pecans on top of it, and then pop it in the oven and get a little gratin, nice little hot sweet potato gratin. And the other thing that's really good is once you peel them, and, like, let's say you have those sweet potatoes left over the next day, is to do a whipped sweet potato. You don't have to add anything to it. You're just going to whip them up, and you could put a little, you know, spoonful of them on a plate as a side dish or accompaniment. I happen to like them also in a hash in the morning for breakfast.
Whoa.
So you take your sweet potato, right?
Yeah.
So you take your sweet potatoes. This is a great way to do your leftover vegetables, too. So you do a root vegetable hash with sweet potato.
Okay.
So you get your leftover vegetables, and you combine those together, and you could add some fresh potato to them or use the sweet potato, and you make a root vegetable hash and put a poached egg on top of it for breakfast.
Whoa. Or even a fried egg if you're, if you're not much of a poacher.
Right, right. But practice poaching. It's good. Good for you.
Okay. All right. All right. You know,
mindfulness practice.
Right, right, right. Now, what are we drinking with this leftover feast of ours?
Oh, well, I mean, what are you into?
Well, Arnold Palmer's myself, but everybody else would hold their nose.
You know, I had a tequila sunrise the other day, and I hadn't had one of those like in 15 years. And I was like, this is fabulous with brunch. I loved it.
What's a tequila sunrise?
Tequila sunrise is tequila, orange juice, and a little grenadine.
Okay.
It was fabulous. I loved it. But I like tequila, too, though. So
how come you're not fat?
Because I do a lot of plant-based eating. I kind of minimize my meats, and I try to exercise. You know, I'm trying to keep the four wheels, you know, going.
Yeah, sure. So, me too. Right.
But so on that note about eating, you know, wine, I'm a big wine lover. So you generally can't lose when you serve a decent quality Chardonnay. And the other one that I really like is in Germany has these unbelievable wines that are, you know, so misunderstood. Everybody thinks they're sweet because you hear German wines, but actually from Alsace, etc., there's a lot of fabulous wines from that region. Another great wine for that time is like Pinot Gris. So Pinot Gris are like this pinkish wine that have just a little bit more acidity that'll hold up to some heavier foods, but not as heavy as a big red wine, not as tannic.
Huh.
That's a good option.
When you were, you know, exercising your meat cleaver as the chief chef in all of these restaurants, these well-known restaurants, did you ever have a sommelier who you had intellectual disagreements with?
Of course.
And how does that come out? I mean, how did you know that? I mean, do you say, what, you served with the, you know, with this or that?
Right. Well, the thing is, the sommeliers are taught an incredible dictionary of floral words. And chefs aren't quite taught those same words. So you'll be talking to someone that's like, my son's actually a certified sommelier, so it's kind of funny having conversations with him now. You know, you'll have these conversations and they'll be like talking in another language. You're like, wait, slow down. Let's talk about, you know, like what I'm putting on the plate and what someone's going to perceive this as. How are they going to understand this combination? So basically what you're trying to do with food in its simplistic way is find something that goes with it that's going to enhance the experience, going to enhance the overall experience. It's going to either juxtapose the food, so it's going to be that much different that it adds an excitement and a conversation to the meal. Or it's going to be something that just balances so wonderfully that it's effortless and makes you feel like that it's just a fluid participation amongst both of them.
Well, easier said than done. I mean, you know, that's great. But what I'm thinking of here is that when, you know, when the waitress comes out, tells you what they got, it's food, and you can pretty well understand it. But when the sommelier comes by, if you happen to ever eat in a restaurant that has a sommelier, then you always feel, oh, I better hide under the table. I'm not good enough to be talking to this guy.
Right.
Do you know what
I
mean?
Well, I find this is generally my rule of thumb. And I know a decent amount about wines, decent amount. But what I like to do is I like to get them to tell me about the wine itself. It's very easy to put a bottle with names that you can't read and verbiage that you don't understand and, you know, wax poetic. But it's a great time when you get a master sommelier that tells you about the winemaker. He tells you about the region it grows. He tells you about the soil and the soil content and why the characteristics of that wine you're about to have are there. They're because of this, because they do this, this they barrel ferment it, it's because they use small cask. So the story is one that makes the meal even more interesting and very, very, that part to me is great. And that's what a sommelier should do for you. A sommelier should bring you into the experience of the wine being grown, like as if the farmer growing the food for you, the sommelier brings you into the experience of the winemaker making that wine for you.
Now let's talk about just. You're supposed to say, just what?
Just what?
Desserts. Just what? Just desserts.
Okay.
So the day after Thanksgiving, we had all those pies and things like that the day before.
Yeah.
Let's assume they're gone. What do you do then?
Right. Well, that's
chocolate pudding.
This is the area you got to be really careful because those are the ones that pack on the pounds.
Right.
Very easily, very quickly, and without you realizing it. I mean, you know, that one slice turned into two slices of pumpkin pie just turned into 1,000 calories for you. So, and your total intake should only be about 2,100 calories. So, you know, you basically can't eat much more for the rest of the day. So it's really something to be cognizant of and to find things that are lighter and more clearing or cleaning. You know, fruit soups might be an option. Fruit in general is something that would probably, you know, be a smart move for you as a dessert item.
Yeah. But what do you mean fruit soups?
Well, fruit soups when you can do something like you could buy frozen berries.
Yeah.
And you could make a fruit soup where you just add a little bit of sugar to it and then you just strain out enough of the liquid. If you add a little bit of gelatin to it, you can thicken it very slightly, and you make a chilled fruit soup.
Where do you get the gelatin from?
You can buy gelatin at any supermarket. Yeah. Every supermarket carries gelatin. It's fairly simple to use. It's not that complicated. So it's like making Jell-O. It's like making your own fresh Jell-O, but very, very light. So it's a little bit more elegant. And then you could just add a little bit of whipped cream, and this way you're not adding all the calories and the fat.
Right.
And then you could put little diced pieces of, like, melon, or if you find some fruit that's actually decent anymore. I mean, I know we have some stores in the Hudson Valley that are fabulous that you could get some decent fruit at this time of year. But you could dice even apples. You could saute them and add them into the fruit soup. Pears, etc. You could poach them, and you could add them into the food soup. And that's a really simple, easy way to do it.
So let me get this straight. Let me get this straight. And by the way, I want to tell everybody that we're talking to the wonderful Dean, Chef Walsh at the CIA Culinary Institute. So let me just get this straight. You are going to do leftovers now, and you've told us 1,000 things we could do to make it interesting. And now for the dessert, you take out and you bring everybody a bowl of soup. Are you sure that it'll work?
Well, I don't know your friends, but in my house it's going to work because they do what I tell them.
Exactly, because you're the chef. I get it. I get that, and I respect it. It's the same way I try to run WAMC. Okay, so now, do you ever give them a little something, little schnapps or something after? Now, you get us up to 2,000 calories, but, you know, a little bit of something, you know. Is there a liqueur?
This time of year always makes me think of eau de vie. And being in the Hudson Valley, eau de vie is they make a pear liqueur, apple liqueurs.
Oh.
A Calvados is probably something everybody knows. That's a fabulous meal ender. And it also helps with the digestive system, according to the French.
Yeah, yeah. How come the French are so skinny and the rest of us are so fat?
Because they understand quality.
Is that what it is?
Yeah, I think they have a culture of food that is very focused on the ingredient quality.
Yeah, fascinating, fascinating. Now, is exercise, you said you were an exerciser. What do? Do you run?
No, I can't run. My knees are too messed up.
Yeah.
But I'm a big yoga guy. So I
really?
Think, yeah, I do a lot of yoga and biking. I love to bike.
Right, right, right. And do you ever miss a day? Do you do it every day?
No, I don't do it. You know, I find that I go through periods where I just don't do anything. And then I'm back focused and I'm obsessive. Every single morning I get up and I do something.
Well, I do it every day.
Good. Good for you.
That's the right answer. Well, good for you.
Do it every day.
Yeah, good for you.
Hey, listen, if I could mentally get my mind around it, I would do it every single day. But the mind is, you know,
Well, but should you do it the day after Thanksgiving? The place we go to, they always take a long, long walk afterwards.
Yeah.
Do you think that's part of that should be part of the required regimen?
I think that would be the best. I think that is a great idea.
Yeah.
Long walk afterwards, great way to exercise and also, you know, appreciate your friends and loved ones.
We've been having a wonderful conversation with you, but we do have 4 minutes and 36 seconds left. What would you like to say in that 4 minutes and 36 seconds that might be, you know, relevant or irrelevant?
Well, I want to make sure that I gave them some good ideas so that anybody that was listening walks away with a few good ideas. One of the things was I kind of harped on the food safety thing only because I'd love to see us as a country bring down the amount of foodborne illnesses that are related to the day after Thanksgiving.
E. coli and what else?
Yeah, and salmonella. Those are some pieces that we are concerned about. And hand washing is probably the biggest thing. I'm on a big hand washing tear this time of year because I don't want people ill during the holidays.
So how should we outfit our bathrooms? Should there be, you know, lots of, you know, towels, separate towels and soaps and soaps?
Well, no, it doesn't have to be that complicated. The thing is just wash your hand with really hot water and take your watch off and wash up to the lower parts of your arms when you wash your hands and scrub
like a
them
surgeon,
really good.
Yeah.
You know, and we'll look at what hospitals do. So hospitals found and the data supports they use a 60% alcohol base as a sanitizer during the course of their work. So they're constantly, did you gel today? That's a conversation that they're always asking. You know, did you gel today? You know, did you finish gelling? Did you finish? So they're reminding themselves culturally to gel, because that sanitizing solution helps to kill off some of the bacteria that's on people's hands.
When you were a major, you still are, but, you know, in running all these restaurants, did you ever find anybody who broke the rule and didn't wash?
Oh, absolutely. And we wear gloves, too. So when we're serving our food, we're wearing gloves. Especially things we call ready-to-eat foods. It's really, really important.
Did you punish the people who didn't do that?
Oh, yeah. Right. When it comes to food safety and food handling, absolutely. Uh-huh. You know, I'm kind of the crazy person about that around here. So that's one. I talked about the thermometer. It's a tool that you should have. You should understand what simmering is and boiling, and you should understand what's 165 and getting foods below 40. I think that's really, really important. I talked about flat cooling. That gets the temperature down. Don't just throw everything in the refrigerator, because you wind up, that's absolutely the worst thing you can do. You bring your temperature, your refrigerator up, and then you kill everything that's in there. So use your cooler. Get some ice if you have a lot of items, and you can rapidly cool them in a cooler with ice. That's a good little trick. Also, in the sink with ice and water, you could cool things down very rapidly. And just remember that thing. Get it below 40 as fast as possible, and get it above 165 to reheat it. In terms of food and leftovers, it's really important to get it above that 165 degrees. But there's a lot of fun things you can do. We talked about soup. Making a soup is very simple. Making stock, making a stew, making a combination stew where you're adding a lot of different vegetables and a lot of root vegetables at this time of year to make something wonderful. And we talked about doing turkey leftovers, turkey pot pies, some ways to lower calorie counts, to focus a little bit more on plant-based foods and honor the meat that we do eat. So I think those are some big messages. I don't know how else I can help.
No, you've done very well. And let me just say, if anybody missed any part of this, you can just go online to WAMC.org and look up Chef Brendan Walsh, the Dean of Culinary Arts at the CIA, the Culinary Institute of America. Chef Walsh, you were wonderful. I had such a good time. Thank you so much for being such a human being. I didn't know what to expect.
Right. Chef people. Well, anyway, I wish you a great holiday season and a lot of health and happiness to everyone.
And to you, Chef. Thank you so much.
Okay, take care.
Been listening to Dr. Alan Chartok, President and CEO of WAMC Northeast Public Radio and Professor Emeritus at the University at Albany. For more information on the In Conversation with Alan series, or to order additional copies of this or any interview in the series, call 1-800-323-9262 or visit us on the web at WAMC.org.